Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. But don't take our word for it. Listen to this voicemail from a subscriber.
I'm calling from West Hollywood. Actually, I'm calling from Washington, D.C. on my way back to West Hollywood. So I have been digging into your Patreon library because I just joined the other day. You've been teasing me with your Patreon, and I am enjoying those episodes very much, and just want to shill for you. Other listeners, join the Patreon. There are some amazing episodes on there. So come join me in Patreon world.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Tasha Robinson
and Genevieve Kosky.
Keith Phipps is out clutching his blue blanket somewhere, but he'll be back for a future pairing. This week, I'm afraid to confess I'm in a terrible spot. As you know, it hasn't been the easiest year for people in the culture writing business, and I need to raise money fast to stay solvent. Well, I had an idea. Those of us in journalism know that if you successfully pitch an article to a publication, and for whatever reason they decide not to publish it, you get a kill fee, right? But lately, I've been finding that it takes a lot of time and effort to deliver a good piece. And sometimes it's really inefficient to spend 2 hours watching the original Love Bug just for an 80-word blurb on a list of 50 recommended titles on Disney+. But if I can get the same amount of money for doing a much shoddier job, then I stand to make a lot in kill fees. So here's what I need us to do. Help me land a pitch for the worst culture feature ever written.
Hold on a minute, Scott. This plan seems really short-sighted. Even if you pull it off and one of your longtime editors accepts the pitch, you can only get away with writing the worst feature ever once. They'll never want to work with you again.
And your reputation's going to take a huge hit. But what if you don't get a kill fee and the piece runs anyway? Bad takes have no place on the internet. The public won't stand for it. No writer who has ever published a bad take after a bad take has ever worked again. You cannot think of a single example to prove me wrong on that one.
But I have so many bad feature ideas. A ranked list of the best Gerard Butler movies, an oral history of the Rob Reiner comedy North to celebrate its 25th anniversary, an unreadable 10,000-word treatise on Alfred Hitchcock's The Paradine Case, a piece about why Miss Piggy is a domestic abuser.
Actually, that last one was published by the New Republic.
Damn it! Well, before I get accused of authoring the worst podcast script ever written, Genevieve, could you talk about this week's pairing?
Sure. The new Taika Waititi comedy, Jojo Rabbit, was a favorite in the fall festivals, walking away with the People's Choice Award at the Toronto Film Festival, which has been the bellwether for a lot of future Oscar winners. Yet it hasn't gone without controversy, specifically for its depiction of Adolf Hitler as a lonely German boy's imaginary friend. But our willingness to accept Hitler as a comic figure goes back a long way, and Mel Brooks' 1967 debut feature, The Producers, suggests why. In a scam that involves staging a surefire flop, a producer and an accountant bank on audiences getting turned off by Springtime for Hitler, a musical that casts the Führer in a heroic light, but instead, they find him hilarious.
So this week on the Next Picture Show, we'll look at The Producers and the unexpected folly of staging the most tasteless play imaginable. Then next week, we'll bring in Jojo Rabbit, a so-called anti-hate satire that tackles the additional challenge of placing Hitler in the context of World War II itself. In the meantime, I have some pitches to send out.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's so simple. Step one, we find the worst plane in the world, a surefire flop.
Springtime for Hitler.
Step two, I raise $1 million and a lot of little old ladies in the world.
I love you.
What?
I love you. I love you!
Step three, you go back to work on the books. Only list of backers, one for the government, one for us.
Hey, I got out of it!
We open on Broadway. Step five, we close on Broadway. Step six, we take our million bucks and we fly to Rio de Janeiro.
Since Charlie Chaplin made The Great Dictator in 1940, cinema has naturally wanted to cast Adolf Hitler as a buffoon. Chaplin's film warned of the rise of fascism and anti-Semitism under Hitler and Mussolini, but his Hitler-esque character, Adenoid Hinkle, exploits all the dictator's mockable qualities. His short stature, his funny little mustache, his petty megalomania, and delusions of grandeur. Though The Great Dictator would go on to become Chaplin's biggest hit, he would later express some regret in his autobiography over having made it, writing that he hadn't known the true horror of German concentration camps at the time. And now, 80 years later, we're still facing the same dilemma. How do you present Hitler on screen? Or more specifically, how can you build a comedy around a man regarded as the most evil figure in a 20th century that had plenty of other candidates? Is it possible in any context to compartmentalize the deaths of millions and get a cathartic laugh from the buffoon whose madness should never have been taken seriously? Mel Brooks' debut feature, The Producers, finds an exceedingly clever way to broach the question. Rather than make a comedy about Hitler, Brooks has made a comedy about the staging of an offensive play about Hitler, which then ironically suggested that, in the right context, people could laugh at him. But even from the satirical distance Brooks allowed himself, The Producers was nonetheless a tough sell. For a first-time filmmaker to get any movie made is hard enough, but he had to overcome a lot of skepticism just to score the modest million-dollar budget he needed. Then the distributor, Embassy Pictures, refused to release it because they found it in quote-unquote bad taste, and its premiere was a disaster. It didn't get much support from prominent critics either. Pauline Kael, Stanley Kaufman, and John Simon all hated it, and Renata Adler in the New York Times called it quote-unquote a violently mixed bag. The Producers has enjoyed a much improved reputation over time, perhaps in part to Brooks' success as a spoof artist behind Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, and in part because it's possible to appreciate the film from a safe distance, when it doesn't seem so controversial. It became a hugely successful Broadway musical, which in turn inspired a hugely unsuccessful film adaptation, and now over 50 years later, we can recognize The Producers as very much the product of an unseasoned filmmaker and see how much it often struggles to incorporate the changes in the culture, with its crude depictions of a Swedish sexpot named Ulla and a hippie actor who goes by Lorenzo Saint Dubois, LSD for short. And Zero Mostel's blustery performance as Max Bialystock, a washed-up theatrical producer who raises money from seducing old ladies, seems like a remnant of an even earlier era. Yet when you think about The Producers, the first things that come to mind are all of its finest aspects. The brilliant premise of a scheme to intentionally stage the worst, most appalling production in Broadway history, only to have it become a smash. Gene Wilder's breakthrough performance as Leo Bloom, a perpetual nervous breakdown of a human being. And the big musical number, Springtime for Hitler, a parody of a showstopper that actually is a genuine showstopper. I'd argue that it's the things we remember about The Producers that have elevated it to the status of comedy classic, eclipsing the things we might rather forget. We'll see if I get any pushback to that argument after the break.
What is your name? Lorenzo, oh, Lorenzo, baby. Lorenzo Saint Dubois. Well, my friends call me LSD. And what have you done, LSD? Oh,
man, about 6 months. But I'm on probation, and I'm cool, man. I'm straight now.
I mean, what do you do best?
Hey, man, I can't do that here. That's why they put me away, baby.
Oh, sing, sing. Oh, thank you. Thank you so very much. We're going to sing. I'd like to, if I may, I'd like to call on my group. They kind of help me a little. Group. Hey, come on, fellas. I would like to sing this song. It's about love and hate. Psychedelically speaking, I am talking about the power.
What is your history with The Producers, and how does it hold up half a century later?
Let me summon a Tasha Robinson-esque sigh of resentment at being put in the position of criticizing a movie so beloved by many.
That's a pretty good Tasha sigh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This was my first time seeing the original Producers. I did see the movie musical adaptation years ago and don't have particularly fond memories of it. Going into this, like, I wanted to like it. I like Mel Brooks. I love Young Frankenstein. I can even like get past the stuff in like Blazing Saddles that hasn't aged so well. Like, I feel like I am capable of getting past the stuff in this movie that is maybe more of its era. But this movie is just like operating on a comedic register that I could not vibe with. Like, from the very first scene, like the credits sequence just felt interminable. Like, it's like it just kept going and going. And like, a lot of it is Zero Mostel's performance, which is just like a level of grotesque that was just like very, very off-putting. And to me, overshadowed the things that you talked about in your keynote as being the things that we remember, like Gene Wilder's performance, which is really good for the most part, but it feels so overshadowed by everything else. And Springtime for Hitler and the whole, like, I feel like the movie doesn't really become the movie it's meant to be until we actually see Springtime for Hitler. And that's like the last 25 minutes of the movie. You know, it's a pretty short movie, but there's a lot of wind up to the central joke of this stage production. And all of that, not all of that wind up, but the vast majority of that wind up was just like very off-putting to me. I had a really hard time liking this movie.
Sure. Tasha, how about you?
I had a really easy time liking this movie.
Okay. Wow, I get to be the Tasha.
Yeah, well, then maybe I'm being the Keith. You know, I think everybody's judging this movie a little bit too harshly, and I'm just going to come in with a nice moderate view. I agree, honestly, that a lot of the humor here is grotesque, that the movie is pretty lumpy, that it's got some real dead spots to it. I think of Mel Brooks as just like a pretty sloppy, throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks, finds hilarity in crudity kind of director. But I saw this film early enough, I think, that it slipped in under my cynicism, and I've seen it enough times that it's got that kind of old friend quality in cinema. And the highlights of it are so funny. But also, I think I may just sympathize a little too much with Gene Wilder as an anxious, like an inherently anxious person who feels like they maybe haven't lived enough and who falls easily under the sway of like somebody charismatic promising him something more. Like the whole seduction, of his character, I just find so ripe and so appropriate. I do think that he and Zero Mostel feel like they're playing in completely different films, but here
in eras, really. Like eras of acting.
Yeah, for sure. Eras of acting and eras of comedy. But that just kind of makes it feel like Zero Mostel is trying to pull Gene Wilder into a different kind of acting, into a different era, into a different phase of humor. And I enjoy the push and pull. There's definitely stuff in this movie that doesn't land with me at all, like the whole I bought myself a toy business. It's pretty rough for a modern woman to see. But the comic timing on certain moments, like the moments when Springtime for Hitler ends and everybody in the theater is appalled except the one person who starts enthusiastically applauding and then they all turn on him. Like there are just laugh out loud moments in this movie that live in a very like protected place in my heart that the bad parts of the movie just can't touch.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of in between the two of you on this one, because I think what's happening here is that we all are kind of recognizing what works about the film and what doesn't, but maybe have a different overall impression of it. You know, I mean, because again, Gene Wilder, Springtime for Hitler, just the basic idea of the movie is really good. I mean, there's I think some pretty good, you know, Zero Mostel is miscast, and I think that if you get a different actor in that role, the movie might have a better chance of success, or that character might pop a little bit more. But it's still, you still get some nice farcical business between the two of them. But there are whole scenes and elements of this movie that really don't work at all. You know, and I was reminded of that catching up with it, you know, again this week for the show. I mean, just like all the stuff with Ula is super embarrassing, and you just get the sense that Brooks was trying to be hip or at least respond to things that were happening in the culture that he had to kind of come to terms with, and he wasn't really able to do it that well. And so you end up with, you know, this libertine sex pot as a secretary, and then you end up with, you know, LSD is playing Hitler, though that performance is kind of funny. It's a little bit, it's bumpy, it's very crude and broad. And I think, you know, when you return to those early reviews, what's striking to me is that even at the time, film critics were kind of picking up on the things about the movie that weren't working. You know, it's not like a situation where, you know, everyone loved it and now we're looking at it and cringing. I mean, people at the time were like, oh boy, this is a little bit amateurish.
Yeah, the amateurishness is what really like sticks out to me. And I mean, obviously it's his first film, you know, so he gets some leeway there, but like, it's kind of funny to me that the sort of the least, not the least, but low down on the list of things that are distasteful about this movie to me is the Hitler component.
Yeah.
And like, that's actually probably the strongest part of the movie for me is that big production number. So reading up on this movie, it sounds like Brooks basically pitched the line, the title Springtime for Hitler. Like he threw it out there and it got a laugh and he like built this movie around that one line. And it feels like it's a series of bits kind of set up to get us to that point, to get us to that big cathartic point, but they don't really like fit together. They don't build in any sort of way. And it's surprising to me when I see this like called a satire, because like I guess you can like kind of squint and call it a show business satire in the idea that, you know, show business people are so blinkered to reality they would make a show about Hitler and not realize what was offensive about that, or you know, like actors are so desperate that they would clamor to play Hitler. And but I feel like that's not actually borne out in any of the comedy of the movie. It's not like satirical comedy that's happening. It's all very slapstick. It's all like, oh, let's watch Max leer at elderly old women and bilk them out of their money for 20 interminable minutes. You know, like
so the film just got off to a pretty wrong foot for you.
I did not care for that opening, but then it happens later too when he's selling 25,000% shares of the production. You know, like it goes back to that again, and we get to watch Zero Mostel manipulating these women, and like it's the same joke done over and over again, and it's not funny the first time, and it's not funny the 17th time, and it's like it seems like a joke that's intended to work in the delivery, as a lot of, you know, Mel Brooks jokes are, but again, Mostel is like very miscast here, and the performance I just don't think jibes with the what comedy is there.
Well, I mean, it's a crude form of humor. It's to begin with, like the gag there is old ladies have sexuality. That's hilarious. So mm-hmm. like even
and they're
if
dumb.
It, oh yeah, sure, they're dumb and manipulable. Although I don't know, there's a snappiness to the way one of the early ladies like gets one over on him in terms of what she wants. There's a degree of owning her sexuality that I still find pretty charming. But that said, I just don't see this as a satire. It's a farce. It's mm-hmm. it's part farce and part incompetent con man movie. It's a heist movie that goes wrong. It's about a couple of it's almost a Coen Brothers movie in just the broadest parameters of a couple of very caricatured, outsized incompetents who are trying to pull off this kind of clever heist and don't do it particularly well, and then it all falls apart and then there's gunfire. I don't see any point in calling this a satire. I don't think it's satirizing anything.
It really is a brilliant idea for a movie though, and I think that carries it a pretty good distance. I mean, to get to that point of the movie where he says, like, you know, what did I do right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. that's a great line, and there's so much that the movie has to go through to kind of earn it. So I kind of appreciate the architecture of the thing for that reason. And you're right, it is a farce. I mean, a farce does have that kind of architecture, does have that intricacy in the way it kind of builds certain elements and then has this payoff in the end. And I think the payoff is really significant and successful. And I also appreciate Brooks's just instincts as a comic writer. I mean, to be able to conceive of this in the first place, to be able to say if I make this movie about the staging of something called Springtime for Hitler and it becomes a hit because people find Hitler actually to be funny in a certain context, that's a pretty bold idea to pursue. And he does it. I mean, I think he proves his thesis on that. In that respect, and you can see how all of this can go down, how you can have this ridiculous script and these ridiculous director and this ridiculous lead actor, and then the chemistry of all that, and the fact that people do want to have this kind of cathartic laugh at Hitler's expense, or is all of that plays is correct, and it could so not work at all.
So does the idea. I mean, this goes right up to the moment where we constantly have, you know, a video or a movie or a book or just a quote going viral, and many, many thousands of people making their living trying to make things go viral, trying to predict when things will go viral, trying to push things to go viral. But ultimately, it's very hard to predict the public taste. I think you're exactly right that just the idea here is so sharp and smart and compelling. The idea of two people shopping around for the absolute worst of everybody in like production that they can find is inherently funny, even if the performances don't quite jibe, and even if just the comic timing isn't there in a lot of these interactions that just go on too long, you know, that go on Saturday Night Live like long after you've gotten the joke and you're ready to be done with it.
Yeah, but a premise isn't a movie. The premise is good, you know, but I the execution. So, Scott, you mentioned like the payoff being so worth it. What are you talking about when you say payoff? You mean the actual production number that we see, or like how the movie actually ends?
The production because, number, like, the climax of the movie, what we're building to.
Yeah, but presumably the climax of the movie is maybe when they try to blow up the theater. Like everything that happens after that, just like the story doesn't know where it's going after that. Like it, or doesn't know how it's supposed to end. You know, like again, this just feels like a movie made in service of this one joke of a Springtime for Hitler. And some of it works and some of it doesn't, but it doesn't hold together as a movie or a narrative for me in any meaningful way.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the stuff after. I just saw it and you forget that stuff is there, that they don't just immediately go to jail after, because they would anyway. I mean, they, you know, once the scam will be revealed if this thing is a hit. So have the additional business of them blowing up the theater is, I mean, though I do again, it's you know, I mean, Mel Brooks kind of gets you with the juvenile humor, but I do like the fast wick, slow wick bit, part of that. That's, you know, that's good, solid Brooks humor. But
and I'm there for the line, I find the defendants incredibly guilty.
Yeah, he's good with that stuff. And I mean, I just, yeah, the actual number is terrific. It's like really well written and choreographed. And
it's
really
such an earworm. Jeez, yeah. It just gets in your head.
Yeah, that's absolutely really good. And it becomes plausible and kind of almost like pointed to me that Hitler becomes funny because he's played by a member of the counterculture, that Brooks has a good sense of like comic chemistry and what, and when you combine these two opposing forces of a peacenik and of you know, the most evil person of the 20th century, that you're going to get, that there's going to be some kind of comic tension there that's going to result in some laughs. And it's hard, I think, for the film to convince you that all of this is going to work, that it's all going to play out the way it does, and that the thing is going to actually be a hit. But that part of it works for me. And I mean, that's a lot. That's all. It takes all of the movie to make that happen. I mean, and obviously getting there is an extremely bumpy ride, to say the least, but it gets there. And I think that's the kind of ends up being the reason why people keep coming back to The Producers as kind of a comedy classic, and why it's on the National Registry, because I think when it counts, the movie scores.
I don't think that it's at all implausible that like all of these terrible things add up into an experience people would love. People love bad movies too. Like people pass around some of the worst terrible movies. Like if you look at something like Troll 2, which is an inherently terrible movie in a baggy, boring, dumb kind of way, but people love to watch it and love to take it apart. I think in the same sort of way, it's not that difficult to believe that people would enjoy a baggy, boring, ridiculous play if it was just so over the top, if the elements of it were so ridiculous and so unlike anything they'd seen before that they felt comfortable laughing at it.
Though I think the people in the audience are believing that that is a good play, not that they're watching something good bad, but that it has been deliberately calculated to delight them and they are delighted by it.
I guess I'm not sure that I buy that. It's just the disbelief from the guy in the bar that's like, who would have ever thought we could love this play? I think that sort of speaks to this concept was ridiculous, and yet I find it strangely appealing. I don't know why. It goes against all of my instincts. To me, it doesn't sound like he necessarily thinks it was calibrated for him so much as it's taken him by surprise. But I'm not sure that it inherently matters hugely. Like that, the audience, the specificities of the audience reaction are such a small part of the story. that I don't think it really necessarily matters whether they think it's bad or good bad. The point is that they really enjoy it and they're going to tell everybody that they should see it for whatever reason. You know, somebody who makes The Happening, which is one of the greatest terrible films of all time, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of showing it to people, might not care so much if people are loving it in a derisive way, if they all go see it in the theater and pay a full price to see it.
Maybe. What do you think?
I was just struck listening to you guys talk that, you know, these audience members did, you know, buy tickets to something called Springtime for Hitler. So they must have had like some sort of thought going into it of what they were going to see. So now I'm just
They have season ticket. They're season ticket holders. Everything at that theater.
Look at something like The Room, though. Nobody who sees The Room and enjoys seeing The Room is under any belief that it's a wonderful movie, but Tommy Wiseau just keeps sort of playing off the fact that people enjoy it derisively.
He's retroactively called it a comedy.
A brilliant satire, much like The Producers.
I reject the premise. I really do. I think that the people in the audience for Springtime for Hitler are appalled by the musical number, and then once Hitler himself kind of comes on stage, then they kind of get it. It's like, oh, wait a minute. All of this is a joke. And this has all been very cleverly calculated to seem tasteless, but is in fact doing something original and fun. I mean, I think they genuinely think it's a good play.
Why does it matter? In the moment where they're laughing hysterically at it, Lorenzo like flopping around on stage saying, leave me alone. Why does it matter that much to you whether they're laughing authentically or derisively?
It doesn't matter that much. I just like to argue with you, Tasha.
It is fun. We have made a 20-year career out of it.
Yes.
Got us to where we are today. I think we should make a Broadway musical out of it and sell 25,000% of the take to somebody.
So I wanted to, one person we haven't talked about, I think we were in agreement that Zero Mostel's performance isn't the best, but Gene Wilder is in this movie. And I think he's fantastic. What did you all think of Gene Wilder in this movie?
I think
he's
somebody
in pain and he's wet and he's hysterical.
That is just such a great bit of just like well calculated escalation. I mean, that is your basic escalation humor where you know exactly where something is going to go as it builds, like in a programmatic kind of way, and he still makes it funnier like with each new step.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just so sickened by every moment. He's upset. You know, I mean, he's anxious. He thinks they're going to get in trouble, which of course they do. But he's got this idea, and he's weak, and he gets this bullied into executing it. And I think that performance is a treat, and the fact that Wilder does play it at a high pitch, like every other performance in the movie. But this is the one case where I think it really connects. I find him funny all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get any argument from me there, you know, even though I definitely have issues with, you know, the way that sort of his character is, you know, moved throughout the movie and placed in relation to Max. Like, I mean, when we're talking about Mel Brooks having a way with just these amazing one-liners and sort of building scenes around that, like Gene Wilder is the voice you want delivering those, not Zero Mostel, you know, like, and there's a reason why they continued to work together and made, in my opinion, their Brooks's best film together, tailored much more to that sort of performance than it is here.
Gene Wilder was in Spaceballs. No, I'm sorry. yes, Young Frankenstein, I assume you're saying yes. There is his best. Yes, I agree.
Controversial opinion, I know. I'm just full
no,
of
it,
them
it is thorough. That one is thoroughly great. There's really not a lot in Young Frankenstein that doesn't work, and there's certainly plenty of lumpiness in his other movies. But what about all these other characters in the movie, though? Ula, Franz Liebkind, Roger
Ula's
Debris.
Not a character.
Yeah, she's a special effect, but yeah. She's not even that. She's eye candy. She's a visual interest. She's a prop. She's a toy.
Yeah. Why is she in this movie?
Well, she's in this movie for skin. I mean, again, Mel Brooks, a lot of his humor is very broad and very crude, and that's why an awful lot of his other cinema has just never resonated with me at all. And here the joke is, She's foreign, so she's dumb. She's blonde, so she's dumb. She's a woman, so she's dumb. And because of all of these things, she's like, she's purchasable. And it's just kind of gross. But I'm going to give a shout out for, I actually really kind of enjoy the character of Franz Liebkind.
Me too.
Franz Liebkind? Franz Liebkind? I don't even remember.
Liebkind, I think.
Franz Liebkind, Kenneth Mars. So we're going to talk in the next episode about how this compares to Jojo Rabbit. And in both cases, a lot of the attention has focused on Hitler and whether it's tasteless to portray Hitler, whether it's tasteless to find comedy in Hitler. But I don't feel like this movie finds that much comedy in Hitler qua Hitler. Like, I don't think it really makes a joke out of Hitler. It makes a joke out of this hippie who doesn't understand Hitler, doesn't understand the threat of Hitler, doesn't understand how to play Hitler. But then you have Franz coming along, and that's where kind of the core of the movie's comedy about Nazis comes in, is in this character who's this very stiff, rigid, over-the-top kind of fascist fanatic who the film openly invites you to laugh at. He's over-the-top. He's foolish in his beliefs. He's completely out of place. He's out of time. He's out of his era. And all of these things are reasons for the film to find him funny and look down on him. I think that the film is looking down on Nazis far more than it's looking down specifically on Hitler. And I find that kind of a bold choice comedically, in sort of the same way that mocking Hitler would be, but it's also broader. It's not just mocking this one short dude with a funny mustache that yells in a language that most of us don't understand. It's mocking like an entire movement. It's mocking an entire belief system. And it's applicable to other forms of fascism, including modern day fascism. It's all about mock the over-the-top belief system of the fanatic. And I think Kenneth Mars just like really brings across that character's like bug-eyed brittleness in a way that makes him funnier than most of the big oversized stereotypes in this film.
Yeah, well, the other thing though is like I don't think that we hate him as much as we should, which is kind of an interesting choice, right? I mean, because he's so screwed up, he's such a simpleton, and has obviously suffered some kind of brain damage, and he's written this play. I mean, he can barely put two words together, and he's written this play that is obviously pretty bad on the page. But there's a weird kind of, ends up being a weird innocence and sweetness somehow to that character. Well, sweetness is not right, but innocent. Like he's just kind of a dumb guy.
I definitely wouldn't say sweetness or innocence. There's a harmlessness to him.
Like a child. He's like a child.
I don't know that he's like a child. I think he's a man out of his time and out of his element in a way that makes him harmless. You know, you get 10,000 Nazis together and put them in charge of a country and terrible things happen. You have one Nazi in, you know, Brooklyn writing plays and suddenly it's comedic because he's completely unmanned. He's emasculated. There's no threat that he can bring to anybody. And at the end of the movie, there's sort of an attempt at a little tension coming out of the potential threat from him. But he's not scary. He's not dangerous, and that's why we can laugh at him. Mel Brooks went in a lot of different directions with Borscht Belt humor, with specifically Jewish humor, with specifically drawing on traditional sources of Jewish anxiety, you know, the Nazis, the Inquisition. And in this case, I feel like he's just defanging Nazism by making the point that you take a Nazi out of Germany and you stick him down someplace else where he doesn't have a weapon or anybody to back him up, or by the end he has an ineffectual weapon, and like suddenly he's a figure of fun.
And you also, in this movie, completely divorce him from any discussion of the Jewish people. You know, like it's very interesting to me that I don't think a character in this movie ever says the word Jew. You know, even though like these are clearly two Jewish characters, you know, is made by a Jewish filmmaker and it's dealing with Nazis and has a Nazi character that it portrays as you're saying, was sort of childlike, not quite innocence, but guilelessness maybe, you know, who is working with two Jewish men to make this musical about Hitler. And that's all just like kind of left on the table for you to like think about or not, you know, like there's no attempt to like make comedy or jokes out of it. And it feels honestly a little lame to me. Like if you're gonna go there, and it doesn't go there. And I feel like it makes it feel a little defanged, especially when it comes to that character who again has some funny lines and is probably one of the better performances in the film, but to me also sort of encapsulates a sort of like limpness of a lot of the comedy here, outside of one-liners and the delivery thereof.
This being the 60s, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Mel Brooks had basically been told that he couldn't make it openly about Judaism, he couldn't bring it up because of the prejudice that they would face. I don't know if remotely Jewish-themed films were ever stuck under the branch of race picture, but, you know, it would have run up against like anti-Semitic messaging, anti-Semitic viewers, anti-Semitic reviews. I think that might just have been something that he couldn't fully get away with. Like so much of the history of gay people in film, I think this is all coded in a way that, you know, if you're part of this group, you're going to recognize it. You're going to recognize something that's aimed directly at you. And it's lampshaded just enough. So maybe if you're outside, if you're in the out group, you're not going to see that. And therefore, you're not going to say, well, this picture isn't for me.
Well, let me offer this idea too, though. That if you remind the audience what Hitler actually did, then it's gonna be a big splash of cold water. I mean, in a way, like, I mean, if you think about even the premise for the play Springtime for Hitler, it's all about Adolf and Eva in I can't even name the getaway they're having there, but it's obviously it's them on vacation or something. It's them enjoying the pleasures of life. It has nothing to do with the build-up to the war or any part of the war, or certainly not genocide, because I think once you actually cross into that terrain, I mean, the film gets edgier, and we've seen examples of comedies that are much edgier than this film as far as that's concerned. But I think there's probably a pretty good reason to not bring up a lot of the things that Hitler did.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Other characters, the concierge.
The concierge, birds. Filthy. That character is just it's a very, like, it's the kind of thing that would show up in a cartoon with Mel Brooks voices. It's yeah. Just like a big over the top you know, Looney Tunes kind of character. I think she's a lot of fun. Just the straight facedness of this person who probably tells literally everybody who she comes across who wants to go by this building or have anything to do with it, how you used to be able to sit out on the stoop like a person, and now you can't anymore.
And what about our director?
Mr. Belvedere.
Is it?
Christopher Hewitt.
Oh my gosh. No, I didn't recognize that. I was talking to our producer, Dan the Snake Jakes, before we recorded. And he was talking about how would you describe it, Dan? Sort of the approachability of Brooks's depiction of the gay Broadway type.
It doesn't feel as malicious as it would appear on its face. Like, even as a kid, I remember like being a closeted teen watching it and thinking, like, I don't know, the show busyness of Mel Brooks makes him one of us in a way that, like, doesn't make it feel like he's talking down to anybody. Like, even any sort of representation, no matter how cartoonish, in that kind of a comedy, like, seems good.
None of that was on mic. It was great. It was really good.
Yeah. For me, the issue with that character comes through more in Leo's reaction to him. Like, he is, like, so visibly repulsed and, like, upset by this man in a dress, and that reaction is played as a joke. And again, it's a joke of the time, but it doesn't feel completely devoid of malice in that moment to me.
Maybe that's just because Leo is such an anxious, uptight little prude to begin with. Like, you can see that as a standard gay panic joke, but you can also just see it as, like, look at this uptight little nerd who can't handle an artist, you know, who can't handle any form of cultural irregularity or, like, somebody larger than life and, like, outside his fear. Like, look how sheltered he is. I feel like at absolute worst, it's like an equal accusation against both of them, as opposed to, you know, having your handsome, two-fisted leading man, like, look down on the pansy. It's more like, oh, honey, there's so much weirder than this going on in New York. What's the big deal? It's a guy in a dress.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of with him, too, of just of him taking in these changes in the culture that were what happening around him in 1967 and having an attitude like, look at all this weird stuff, right? Like, look, and isn't that kind of funny? So maybe there, and with that, perhaps there's an absence of malice, right? But it's an interesting character, and I mean, it definitely, it's fascinating to think about this movie as a product of its time, as a 1967 movie. I think you could carbon date it pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk kind of about the bigger picture of Mel Brooks in general, and you know, Mel Brooks is one of those guys who these days is perpetually kvetching that, you know, I couldn't make my movies these days because people are too sensitive. Like, people won't let you be funny anymore. People judge you for, like, making fun of, and what he means is for making queer jokes and dumb blonde jokes and black jokes. And, like, basically, I mean, he was a pretty equal opportunity mocker of, like, all races, creeds, and colors. But a lot of his humor is just very, very cheap and feels very, very, oh, Keith's not here, I get to say it, dated. and like listening to him complain these days about how, like, he can't do these, like, kind of weak, like, hey, this guy's fruity, he's wearing a dress, hey, like that level of gag where there is no other level. It's just he is different from what we expect. Like, I don't mourn the fact that movies aren't being made like this these days anymore.
One thing I would say, though, is that with so many of these movies that people talk about, oh, you can't do this, that you used to be able to do that, you know, it was fine, nobody fussed. I mean, the thing is, people fussed. As I mentioned in the intro, three of the most widely read prominent critics in the country absolutely detested this movie for its crudeness, for its broad stereotypes, for all those elements. And that happens so often when people talk about, oh gosh, this old movie is now canceled because of the way we look at things now. And it's like no, look at the actual reaction to this movie at the time. Those sentiments are very frequently expressed, you know, in print, you know, that hasn't changed that much. And with Mel Brooks, I mean, he's had a very up and down career review wise, and has been picked on for the very thing he's talking about. Maybe he's talking about just getting his films financed, I guess. I don't know, but he's 93 years old. You know, I mean, he's had a great career. I think he's pretty well revered, you know, but I guess, you know, you get older and you get cranky. I get that. You get a little cranky, but it's tiresome.
I don't know. I'm with Renata Adler on it being a violently mixed bag. I think I actually read some excerpts from that review, and it seemed like her objections had less to do with the quote unquote offensiveness of it and more just sort of the amateurish filmmaking and the performances, which are where most of my issues lay as well.
Yeah, it is pretty amateurish in the sense that it really often feels like, let's aim a camera at these guys. And I mean, it's got a bit of a feel, especially in some of the Zero Mostel scenes, of modern improv comedies, mm-hmm. where somebody said, well, these guys are funny, we'll just point a camera at them for 20 minutes and edit it down to the best three. And the best three end up feeling like the best 10, because they're not plotted, they're not calculated, they're not paced. They're just people riffing and reaching for the best joke that they can find. Here, I think a lot of the stuff that Genevieve identifies as repetition does sort of feel like almost coming out of like a silent movie ethos of, we'll point the camera at you and then I'll just yell, like, now woo her. Find it flattering that he's wooing you. We're just going to keep running until that's out. It doesn't feel tightly scripted and tightly paced. It feels like a joke being kind of explored like randomly and wildly on screen sometimes.
See, I guess I would, you know, I push back a little bit on that, because I do think, you know, right at the beginning, I mean, it's overlong. There's no question that
93 minutes.
It takes, not the movie. I'm just saying that opening bit.
Okay.
And all the stuff, okay. You know, the stuff with just Zero Mostel and the old ladies. That's the really long part. Gene Wilder comes in, and I think that stuff is a little better. But there is a plan there. There are things that need to get accomplished narratively that Brooks is mindful of, and I think there is an overall kind of like game plan that he's executing here. So it is very written in that respect. But it's just, a little loose. I mean, it's a first-time filmmaker, doesn't know what he's doing. He makes some errors, a lot of errors.
Sure. You compare like something like that Hold Me, Touch Me scene with the Boyd's monologue, which is short, sweet, and to the point. And it feels like it was written by a different person.
Yeah. Hold me, touch me. It's good stuff.
The name Boyd. Of her character, by the way, speaking of characters as concepts, Hold Me, Touch Me.
Yeah, at least Ula got a name.
Presuming we have no more to say about Ula, we can move on to feedback.
Scott and Genevieve, move on to feedback.
Now it's time for feedback, when our listeners weigh in with their responses to recent episodes or anything else in the world of film. We're always happy to get a good anything else in the world of film letter, like this one on trailers. Tasha, want to read it for us?
Sure. Adam writes, I recently fell down a Terminator rabbit hole leading up to Dark Fate because apparently I'm Matt Singer's long-lost brother. After watching T2, I recalled it was a movie of the week at the Dissolve, RIP, and decided to read about a movie that had had a profound impact on my life as a lover of film. Tasha's Dissolve essay about the spoilerific T2 trailer got me thinking about Parasite, which has a trailer that goes to painstaking lengths to not give anything away. So this led me to think about a few questions I'll ask you to help me with. 1. Who decides what does and doesn't go into a trailer? How much input, if any, do directors have in the way their movie gets marketed? 2. How much of a factor do you think access to trailers has changed the way they are used as a marketing tool? When T2 came out in 1991, the only way to see the trailer was in theaters or on TV. Now we have instant access to any movie trailer in the world whenever we want, and there are instant reaction videos on YouTube to these 2-minute sales tools. 3. A follow-up to number 2. If it has had an impact, do you think it's made a difference in how we engage with the actual movie upon release?
To answer the third question, I think it's profoundly impactful in terms of the way trailers and just marketing materials in general really frame our expectations for what a movie is going to be. So I think it's critically important, and I think it can be kind of disastrous sometimes. I think Last Christmas is a pretty good example of that, of a trailer that had enough information in it to where it's like, whoa, did we just figure out what this movie is? And I think we did, as it turns out. And I don't think that was helpful to the film. I mean, again, I don't have the numbers to back that up, but my sense is that that was damaging to include as much information as that movie did, to where people could kind of figure out, oh, this has a twist that's sort of based on that song. And I think I've just seen the whole thing.
I never saw the trailer for that movie, but I can tell you that it's pretty traditional for rom-com trailers specifically to basically give away the whole movie. And I've always associated that attitude with the idea that rom-coms are very specifically for people who want a certain kind of escapism where they know everything that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I've read interviews with people who say, I only go to movies where I know everything's going to happen. Like, I want to be comforted. Kind of people that go to rom-coms, that go to very conventional rom-coms, and to some degree even romantic dramas, like, want a certain form of fairly soft, comforting, predictable escapism. So I can see where that one bit itself in the foot. I can see where that one shot itself in the foot.
Bit itself in the foot.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Fine. I can see where that one bit itself in the ass by trying to do what trailers normally do these days, particularly in the genre, and then it was just a bridge too far. I do think, for me, I hate that feeling of where you're sitting in the theater waiting for your actual movie to begin, and you see a trailer and you say, oh, that was a pretty good film. I've seen every beat in that film. I don't need to see that film.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to answer number 1, who decides what does and doesn't go into a trailer, and how much input do directors have in the way their movies get marketed. I'm sure that there are people listening to this who are actually in the film industry. We've heard from some of them who would have a better and clearer perspective on that. And those people should write or call in. But from reading interviews with directors about exactly this over the years, I'm going to say it varies. It mm-hmm. like so yeah. many other things, it varies a lot depending on the size of the movie. You know, the movie that costs $200 million, the director is way less likely to have any say whatsoever in the marketing.
And how much of that budget is marketing.
Yeah, exactly. What? Over somebody who's like an indie director is probably cutting that first trailer themselves. So they've got a lot more say in it. But some of the more persnickety directors or some of the more cloudy directors like James Cameron might actually write into their contract that they have final approval on trailers. And Cameron, I believe, would want that specifically because how T2 was marketed. So it ranges very widely, but the norm is just that, no, the studios control that kind of thing. If it's a studio of any size whatsoever, if it's a movie of any size whatsoever, there are professional trailer cutters who only cut trailers, and they're making these decisions. The marketing teams are making these decisions, and the directors aren't. And I have read many interviews with directors who were very upset about the way their films were marketed. In some cases, A24 is particularly bad about putting out trailers that are designed to get butts in seats, but that are not reflective of what the actual movie is. Mm. And you look at something like They Come at Night or The Witch, you look at the contrast between the trailer and the actual film, and you can see where people are being pulled into the theater under false pretenses and walking out angry and lambasting the movie, and then the directors are unhappy about that. So I'm sure there are just as many directors that are thinking, why did you give away the biggest explosion, the best special effect, the most dramatic moment in the movie? There's certainly a lot of tension, as in so many other industries, between like the marketers, the salespeople, and the artists who are making the film.
Before we leave this topic, I do want to bring up something that just happened fairly recently, where the second Sonic the Hedgehog trailer was released. And this might be unique in at least in recent film history. I can't think of anything that's happened like this, where the fan reaction, not even just fan, just like when people's reaction to a trailer actually ended up changing what the movie was. In this case, the character design of Sonic the Hedgehog, because people were so viscerally repulsed by what they saw in the first trailer. And I find that really, really remarkable, and actually kind of a encapsulation of the second question here about how we engage with trailers has changed since, you know, 1991, and sort of the anticipation culture, whatever you want to call it, that we've formed in the last decade or so has resulted in a sort of trailers become a not just a discussion piece, but almost like meme fodder, you know? And I mean that like in the more broad sense of meme, and then specifically the internet sense. People engage with the trailer as its own thing, and it shapes our feelings about the movie before we see it. And it becomes its own discrete object, but also one that keeps building upon itself, because you have a teaser trailer, then you have a full trailer, then you have a second trailer. And so the buildup to the movie becomes its own cultural object beyond the movie itself. And for me anyway, like I try to avoid trailers and teaser trailers as much as possible, because that sense of build that we get around big movies in particular, by the time the movie comes out, I'm like pre-exhausted by it a lot of the times. And I don't like that feeling. Like, I don't like the feeling of going into a movie of like, all right, well, I've been hearing about this for this many months, and I've heard this many jokes about the trailer, and I know that this moment is coming. And like, that's not how I want to engage with a movie. I understand that maybe some people do, but I try to avoid trailers.
I'm in the same boat. I try to avoid them, and I almost resent the degree to which there's an industry now around trailer reactions and trailer frame by frame analysis and trailer pick aparts. Like, I honestly don't understand the mentality of people that are excited to watch somebody else kind of like performatively gawp at an ad. And I mostly just resent that whenever I get on YouTube to look for something in particular, especially a trailer to embed in a piece that I'm putting up professionally, it's hugely outnumbered by the what seems like the exact same freeze frame over and over of an image from that trailer, and then whoever's responding to it with their mouth open in huge, exaggerated, performative, I can't believe it, shock. I don't understand the people who are like, I really want to watch somebody watch an ad.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a big thing. It's changed the way people respond to movies, in that people have started resenting movies months before they can see them. Like there's so much anger now that comes out over just, you know, this trailer came out. Is the new Star Wars isn't going to have fill in the blank thing that you love in it at all because this one trailer didn't have that? I don't understand that level of knee jerk reaction.
And the movie can turn out quite differently from the trailer and defy a lot of the chatter around it. I mean, I think of just The Irishman for one. I mean, like The Irishman wasn't a very good trailer, but it also gave you the impression that it was kind of just like every other Scorsese film or gangster film in terms of its style and pace. And it's not. It is the metabolism of that film is way slower and pretty kind of a departure for him. And you wouldn't know that until you actually experience the movie. It's frustrating. For sure. And I find it exhausting as a moviegoer to go to a theater and see, you know, 9 trailers before my movie starts. I'm like done with the whole movie going experience before it even starts because I'm so wrung out.
Yeah, I remember when we used to like literally sit in the theater excited when a trailer came on because it, you know, it meant we were getting like a little tease of something to come, like a little bonus with our meal, like a little snack before our meal. But that was when there might be 3 or 4 trailers.
Yeah.
When there are 9, no, I'm right there with you. I can't tell you how many times I've been in the theater and had the trailer stop and the movie start, and I literally cannot remember what I'm there to see after like 25 minutes of being pummeled with ads.
Yeah, and you're spent in a way. You're no longer going to a movie fresh. You're kind of like wrung out. Well, we did have another piece of feedback about Parasite and related issues, but we've gone on long enough, so we're going to save it for another episode. So consider this a trailer of things to come.
Kind of a little teaser.
Get excited for a Parasite-related query.
This is my performative gasp face that I cannot believe what I'm actually hearing right now. Gasp. Click like and subscribe, fam.
So we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll look at Taika Waititi's Jojo Rabbit. Look for that next Tuesday, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. Even better still, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, remember that we are the authors, and you're the audience, so we outrank you.